The dawning sun rose maroon and fiery over the Algonquin plain. A coarse, hot wind blew through the grove of Klondike trees, and the roosting Pembroke hens responded with an insane chattering that abruptly woke the interloping composer and put his teeth on the edge of his pillow. That's not the insane chattering that I had hoped for.
No, it's definitely not very insane.
Later. No, ah. No. Oh, well, I guess we'll have to leave that door.
Wait for insane chattering.
Yeah. We don't have enough time. We'll have to move on. Maybe I can come back to that and allude to the insane chattering at that time. Well, there's a little bit there. But still, he managed a crooked smirk, for this remote plateau with its bizarre denizens was exactly the environment in which he wanted to stage his last public performance. He said as the telephone rang and the person watching the script was not aware of the ringing telephone. 826888. Anyway. The date was January 23rd, 1989. The composer was Salva Dali, and he had come here to die. Unknown to all but a handful of close chums and musical scholars, Dali... Wait, there's that insane chattering that abruptly woke the composer. Ah, finally. Unknown to all but a handful of close chums and musical scholars, Dali was a closet composer when he wasn't hand-numbering one-off wiggly clock mimeographs for museum gift shops. His tunes weren't composed so much as they were upholstered. He would take a piece of thematic material from an acoustic event in the natural world, then he literally stuffed it, added springs and cushions, and finally covered it with a kind of quasi-musical fabric. The result was often the auditory equivalent of staring at the sun for an hour. At first, the observer was aware of only bright pain. But then, as... Wait, here's that insane chattering again. Doesn't last long, but that's the way pen...
Neither does insanity, so...
Oh, right, yes. Ah, the result was often the auditory equivalent of staring at the sun for an hour. At first, the observer was aware of only bright pain. But then, as the hydrogen rays bombarding the eye sockets precipitated an irreversible chemical reaction in the zonule of Zinn... creating permanent green dots on the pupils and, in turn, chronic blepharospasms. I've been pronouncing it wrong all these years.
It just sounds better as
blepharospasms. I'll still pronounce it that way. The event became more than a wee happy tune. This was Dali's outlandish musical legacy. Refitting his upper plate to his gums, Dali tried to sit up, but a painful twinge from his distended neck forced him back down. He was suffering from an infected goiter the size of a hubcap from a 49 DeSoto, and the thyroid gland was gradually reversing hormonal production, turning his infamous mustache into a 6-foot cartilaginous peptide. Several members of his retinue heard his early morning rustlings and entered the dimly lit tent. Lying prone and glazed upon a cot, upholstered with 25 years of symphonic struggle, he did not look comfortable. A short, wiry woman who had secretly shared an...
Wait, what? I was just thinking about that. It was upholstered with symphonic struggle, which is what he did with his tune.
Exactly
no
right.
No wonder why he was sort of struggling on the cot. I feel the same way.
Yes.
All those violin bows poking me in the back. Oh, there's that insane shattering again.
It comes and goes, as does... Well, never mind. A short, wiry woman who had secretly shared an out-of-body experience with a great man years ago stepped forward and attempted to fluff up his pillow. Perhaps vacillating between in and out-of-body himself now, Dali suddenly shot up, sat up. Oh, chattered insanely. grasped her arm, and called out that he was being dunned by a giant squid. Le flambeau orange. Then the struma abruptly swelled and, accompanied by a blood-curdling shriek from the composer, exploded. What happened to the insane shattering?
This is just definitely out of sync with this insane chorus. They're just trying to subterfugify this thing.
Then the struma abruptly swelled and, accompanied by a blood-curdling shriek from the composer, exploded, plastering entirely too much of the composer's innards from the abdomen on up onto the tent walls. Shards of the latissimus dorsi wound up on the woman's face, and she ran screaming from the tent. I don't suppose we have any musical...
Shard music?
Sure. No, that's not the screaming I had in mind, but oh well. Ruffled anew, the Pembroke hens began again their grating bird babble. Yeah, all right. What a choice.
Yes.
And the other observers quickly abandoned the tent to chase them away. Soon, all was once more quiet. And here I think we can be accommodating.
Okay.
Yeah, that's once more quiet. Where? Oh, save for the snarling of the still rising sun. In fact, the visitation of the large carnivorous cephalopod at death's door is unsettlingly common among composers whose last words have been audience documented. What draws the image of a giant's squid into the alleged mind of a music monger en route to meet his or her manufacturer? For an answer, we must first ask the squid.
Oh, I'd like to do that. I would so much like to ask the squid. Will there be an opportunity to ask
I'm
the
sure
squid?
In the future, but alas, not today.
I wish we were asking squids. Yes.
Long-time listeners to this program will quickly realize that this is nigh on impossible.
Oh, I knew it. I just knew it.
Since well-heeled research scientists have concluded on more than one grant-funded occasion that the colossal mollusk is not much of a talker. The only secrets he is likely to share deal with out-of-body experiences that border on the apocryphal, much as this 192nd episode of Calvus and Damian's New Music Bazaar borders on the 191st. That is, while it shares the name, the similarity stops there, as does the buck, which will now be passed to him who hopefully has a couple of them in his pocket. Calvus.
Wait, let me just see. Wait, not in that. In that one, I have a wet tissue. In this pocket, I have an empty wallet. Wait, here's one. Yes, here are some leftovers, just enough to purchase some pizza.
Ah, good enough.
My, that was very entertaining. That gave me a lot of ideas, reminding me of the Zanul of Zin was the most important one.
Yeah, yes.
Excellent. Well, let's just finish listening to this. It's music here, this Krzysztof Penderecki, and then we'll come back and discuss why Penderecki is relevant to today's program.
Well, his relatives are on this program.
Yes.
And maybe talk again about the Vermont State Song Competition.
Oh, that.
Thank you.
good old tunes.
Yes, nice. safe tunes.
Safe. Stabat Mater, followed by Miserere, both by Christoph Penderecki. This is, when are these pieces written? 1960s?
I thought it was not 59.
Perhaps they are. I don't know. Anyway. Nice old tunes. Yes. Penderecki, a very formidable composer.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting that you should choose Penderecki because he's one of the folks with whom our guest on today's show studied. Our guest today is John McGuire, who will be here in 15 minutes at the top of the hour, and he studied with both Penderecki and Stockhausen.
And how does the Andrew Lloyd Webber influence infiltrate his tunes?
Don't we wish? We will hear quite a bit of John McGuire in the course of the following 2 weeks. If we say the following 2 weeks, does that include the present one?
Not if you're speaking the pluperfect.
Pluperfect, yes, which we are. How about some stuff that we got from recently from Mills?
Well,
College.
I'm certainly keen on that. Yes. Mills has been one of your favorites targets.
Yes. We have received three CDs. One is simply called Tuning at eartha.mills.edu, a microtonal music experience. New tuning structures and ideas and concepts are big at Mills and at a few other places where you rethink how the temperament of what you do is placed. And we have pieces here that are 23 tones per octave, 19 tone just intonation, 19 tone equal temperament, 10 tones to the octave, 13 limit just intonation, etc. So how about we play a couple of them?
I'm keen for
Here's one by John Loffink. John is the person who actually sent us this little clot of CDs, so I think we should respond actually playing playing the tunes. And this is a piece by John in 13 limit just intonation called Resuscitation. How I'd like to know about that. Here we go. Music by John Loffink.
Thank you.
I must admit I was a bit lost in that.
How do you mean lost?
I couldn't follow.
Oh.
I enjoyed it.
I did too.
But I wasn't sure.
Right. I know. Once that the little scaly passage came by and kept hitting me over the head with it, it didn't matter. I liked the scale. I found it soothing.
Good scale.
Yes.
That was a good scale. Let's listen to another one. How about, well, a couple more of these things. Let me just one for the moment. This is Stephen James Taylor's Mood of Neptune, Ashes Before the Sky, in a 23-tone scale after your own heart.
Yes.
Derived from the Fibonacci sequence.
Oh, yes, my friend.
Here it is, then. From Stephen James Taylor, Mood of Neptune, Ashes Before the Sky, in 23-tone Fibonacci series.
Thank you.
From the CD Tuning at eartha.mills.edu, a microtonal music experience. That was Stephen James Taylor's Mood of Neptune, Ashes Before the Sky, 23 tones to the octave.
I'm glad to see Mills has a sense of humor. I think these are the two that I've heard are dandy. I'm keen to hear more.
So am I. That was
quite
good.
I like this microtoning stuff.
Yes. Tuning. Microtoning?
Microtoning.
Micro-intoning stuff. Well, we're just about to, if things work out here technologically, hear an interview with John McGuire, our composer for the day. However, I just installed the tape in the machine, and it seems to have rejected it. So
I see. There is a backup unit recall, you may remember.
I tell you what, let's play one more tune from
good.
The microtonal thing.
Here
let's
on
play
Calvos and
Damien's New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. It's the top of the hour, and we get to do that. Number three, which is John Starrett's Citified Notions, 19-tone equal temperament, which you liked because it was called a whacked out.
Whacked out, yes. And I'm ready for more whacked out.
Oh, well, whack away. Here it is.
I realize there are some performers who do that unintentionally.
Unintentionally, yes. That's John Starrett's Citified Notions. I remember Clarence Barlow, who did stuff in 19-tone intonation, used to say that this was perfect for a lot of blues and because the notes sort of fit right into the interval structure. And he did a piece called Auto de Blue, we played on the show,
yes,
is the
right.
same example of that. So, pretty cool. Well, that's fun. Fun. Something from Mills that's fun. Two things from Mills that's fun. Something's wrong with the state of the earth when you get stuff from fun from Mills. Well, we're about to have our interview with John McGuire, and we're listening right now to the first of his 48 variations for two pianos, played by Herbert Henk and Deborah Richards.
You know, there's a connection here with one of the performers.
Yes, Deborah Richards, who we've both met and who also played music of Barlow. And
you kept trying to get her, get an interview with her, did you not?
We just couldn't coordinate when we were there last time. So maybe one of these days we will get that long-sought interview with Deborah Richards, who also, by the way, studied with Stockhausen and played his stuff and also translated one of his lengthy papers from German into English. So a lot of connections here, since John McGuire also studied with Stockhausen and Ligeti, who we heard earlier in the program. And studied with Penderecki and went to lectures by Ligeti. Well, let's listen to some music and then go to the interview.
On the 35th floor of a hotel in New York City, the wind.
Mm.
You're listening to the Cowboys of Avian New Music Bazaar. And we have a guest from fresh from Europe, so to speak, where you have resided for how long?
I was in Cologne for 32 years.
32 years.
Sorry, I wasn't in Cologne for 32 years. I was in Germany for 32 years. I've been in Cologne since 1970.
Wow. My goodness, the wind is just taking off here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope we don't.
Oh, goodness. Well, John McGuire.
That's right.
That's right. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm going to let you take it for a while. Tell your story, tell where you've been and what you've done and how you started and what you're doing now. Start way back when. When you started composing. And what took you to Europe many years ago, and why you stayed?
Well, those are two or three different starts you're talking about.
Sure.
I started composing when I was a freshman in college, and kept on until I was in graduate school. At which point, I was given a scholarship to go to Europe.
Uh-huh.
That was in 1966. And the reason I wanted to go to Europe was because I was interested in the European avant-garde at the time, and I wanted to go to Darmstadt and see what they were doing there.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
At the time, was still one of the great centers of experimental music of all kinds. Who was there when you wanted to go?
Well, the first year I was there, the lectures that I really noticed were being given by Maurizio Kagel,
right.
George Ligeti, and Stockhausen.
Right. All of whom we have heard on this program and
uh-huh.
dearly loved as our kind of mentors.
Uh-huh.
So Darmstadt, which remained the center for many years and for many people still is a big center of contemporary. So you wanted to go there and see.
Yeah, I wanted to go there and see what all the fuss was about.
And so I did.
And I also went there the next 2 years where seminars in composition were being offered by Stockhausen. I participated in those too, so-called composition studios. 12 composers were okay to come and be in his seminar for 3 weeks.
What was it like? What was it like at Stockhausen at that time? What was it like being in the seminar?
Well, I really have to backpedal and think about that. That was in 1967 and 1968. My first thought when I think back on it was that it was initially very intimidating to me. I found Stockhausen a terrifically intimidating person.
Yes.
And also, in terms of what was coming out from him, musically, musical ideas, very, very exciting as well. There was just, every day, some new idea about music was being discussed that was unlike anything I'd ever seen or heard before.
Such as? I mean, a lot of them will be familiar to us, of course, today, because it's our heritage. But what did you discover there? What kind of things stick in your mind as great moments of revelation?
Again, I'll have to backtrack and think about it for a minute. What we were doing in 1967, or I should say what he was doing,
yeah.
was exploring something like symbolic languages for interactive composing on several, or with several points of reference at once, like 12, 24 different points of reference going simultaneously. This, in 1967, was really something very new.
Mm-hmm.
And bewildering
to
everybody involved.
To our listeners, what does that mean to have multiple points of reference in a piece of music?
Well, you'd be talking about a source which is being reacted to, which in turn is reacting. Those would be two things that I would call points of reference.
And the source would be a person, device,
Well, you could define it as a source of sound or of information. In which case, it could be a device or a notation or person.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anything else right now. So
that and what else? Stockhausen. What was Stockhausen working on in those years?
Well, in 1967, he was working on a piece called Hymnen for electronic sounds. You smile as though you know the piece well.
It's just a grand piece. It's huge. It's long. It's a gigantic piece.
Yeah. It's 2 hours long. Yeah. I think it's a single arc.
Yes.
2 hours. Yes. I don't know of anything else like it, really. And the piece also has communicates to me anyway an elan in composing that's really very impressive, and he was like that piece.
Yes.
So that's one of the things that made him so intimidating.
So you were there and being intimidated. Mm-hmm. And being excited by what was going on. Mm-hmm. You said you wrote from when you were in high school to when you were in graduate school. The implication from what you said was that you stopped. Does this experience have anything to do with that? Did you stop, and did this experience have anything to do with it?
No, I didn't mean to imply that I'd stopped.
Oh, okay.
I kept going on through. I started when I was a freshman in college.
College, sorry, yeah.
I didn't get the idea before when I was in high school. No, I didn't stop. I went on. I was at the same time I was going to Darmstadt in the summers of 67 and 68. I was also during the school year. I had enrolled at the conservatory in Essen, where I was studying with Christoph Penderecki. A more kind of traditionally oriented exercises in counterpoint and instrumentation, and showing him what I was writing with it and that kind of thing.
I have to ask once again, what was in 60 seconds, can you say what it was like to be a student of Penderecki?
Well, it was exciting to me. Quite different way than Stockhausen. I mean, he was real, what shall I say, East European virtuoso musician type composer. And I, having come from this very intellectual music department in Berkeley, California, was confronted with a virtuoso practitioner.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to me to see almost the opposite end of the scale there. So I took up writing my counterpoint exercises as fast and furiously as I could. I was working 16, 18 hours a day sometimes for Penderecki. Trying to learn to do it that way too. So those were a couple of extremely exciting years for me, to work with Stockhausen and Penderecki.
So what had you been writing before, and then what happened? And should we take a break and listen to something at this point? Is this a good time?
If you'd like, sure.
Great. What should we do?
I'll let you decide if you think it would be appropriate to listen to something.
Well, here's some music by our guest today on the show, John McGuire, and we'll be right back and tell you then what you heard.
We'll tell you right now what you're about to hear, and that will be Vanishing Points, an excerpt of that, of music by John McGuire. Vanishing Points. Thank you.
we left you in your career, as you had just moved to, maybe not a career yet, maybe you were still not viewing it as a career, or were you? How did you, it's so many, there's so many questions here. Mm-hmm. How did you become a composer in the midst of all of that? Did you suddenly decide at some point that that was going to be the case? Was it sort of a magic moment, or did you just work your way into becoming a composer and decide it was a commitment?
I think it was one of those moments that might be described as having some magic about it. The first time I wrote music and heard it, I just kind of went a little crazy and thought, you mean you can actually do this?
And heard it, you mean it was performed?
Yeah,
you mean?
Yeah.
And was that while you were in college?
That was while I was in college.
Wow.
I was a freshman in college.
I must admit, I understand that feeling. The first time you hear someone else perform one of your own pieces, it's so different from the imagining of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the imagining of it is so exciting by itself. And then there's that moment when not you yourself, but someone outside you, taking what you have, what's yours. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that happened while you were in school. And then from there?
Well, I just decided right away that I was going to keep doing that. It seemed to me that it was the only thing I'd ever done that I found that I really just totally loved doing.
Mm-hmm. And so you went, did you say it was a fellowship to Darmstadt? Or
yeah.
And you just stayed.
Well, I had two years of traveling scholarships from Berkeley. The first year was a scholarship for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so
I got it renewed, and after that I just stayed. I came back to Berkeley for a year in 1969. I got my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And got to know some things of music that were very interesting too.
So you spent how long back after?
I was a year in 1969, yeah. And then I went back to Germany.
You went back.
For the whole
now, by that time, you were done with sort of the school, so to speak. The fellowships were over.
The fellowships were over.
How did you stay alive?
Well, by hook and crook.
Was it then that you began studying with Ligeti, or were you studying with Ligeti and Stockhausen and Penderecki and all these folks and Kagel only in the first day?
I'd never studied with Ligeti or Kagel. I went to their lectures in Darmstadt.
Okay.
It was only the Stockhausen and Penderecki.
Okay.
And later I also attended lectures at Utrecht from Gottfried Koenig to get to know the computer and electronic music computer angle.
So you're back in Germany by about 1970 then.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And are you a performer as well, or were you largely creating pieces for others to perform, or for?
Well, I was performing for a while. I was performing other people's stuff too,
as a
part-time orchestra pianist with the Saarbrücken Radio Orchestra.
Okay.
And for a while, I was also a church organist.
They let you do that there.
Why wouldn't they?
There are many sort of stories, probably all apocryphal, that in Germany one could only be in German and be a church organist because it was such a local kind of sound that was required.
That may well be the truth. I just happened to luck into this. To this church organist job, which was actually before I had an Irish organist, an Irish composer.
Uh-huh.
You may know Gerald Barry. He was my predecessor at this job.
And was this in Cologne at the time? You were there by then?
In a small town outside of Cologne.
Outside. And there, where did you go from there? I mean, what began to happen? And how? And about tell us about the style you were. You started composing in. You first started in college in America on the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
and you certainly must have had ideas that you wanted to work on. And what were you? Where did you start stylistically? And where did you end up after a few years with Stockhausen?
Well, where I started stylistically, I probably started in the center of L.A., you know. There was there were elements of Schoenberg and Stravinsky and Webern and Miklos Rocha all mixed up, you know, together, just the way they are in L.A.
That's good.
Things started getting added to that.
Yep.
And other things started getting filtered away from all that stuff.
And where did you find yourself by the time you returned to Cologne? What was happening by then?
By the time I returned to... You mean when I came back from Berkeley in 1970?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. I had... spent 3 years on a piece for 8 French horns in which I had very deliberately decided to more or less summarize everything I'd been able to learn from Stockhausen and Penderecki, with basically the idea of getting rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of my last student piece, a kind of doctoral thesis, you might say. And where I was heading when I went back to Germany was... Well, I tell you what I picked up in California in 1969 was a strong interest in patterning. For want of a better word, people call minimalistic kind of patterning. I was starting to work on that in a piece for 4 pianos that I started in Berkeley in 1969 that took 4 years to write. And... what I was looking for there was a way of incorporating, in particular, what I'd been so impressed with in Stockhausen's research into composing with various parameters within the totality of what he called time.
Mm-hmm.
And applying that to this kind of pattern music that I was getting interested in. So you might say a kind of serial approach to minimalist pattern music.
Do you have an example? Have you brought along an example you can play?
Well, actually, everything I've written since then has been working on that problem, really. So I don't have anything that's not an example of that, really.
Okay. Well, let's play one of those, and we'll come back with the interview with John McGuire.
Okay.
After this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Trees by John McGuire, our guest on the Calvis and Damian show today. And John is very quiet, so that makes me very quiet to change instead of the usual antics. You said you've been working on it in a sense ever since. What would be considered a solution to the problem?
To which problem?
Of bringing together these, the patterning and the surrealism. I misheard you, but I thought you said something to the effect that you were working on this problem.
I see. Yeah, sorry, I got off the track. What would be considered a solution?
I mean, if you've been working on it, maybe you have sort of the dream piece there somewhere that you're hoping you will write at some point.
Well, all you can do is propose various approaches. One approach I've taken several times is to start out with a what you might call, now I'm a little bit translating from the German to the English, what you might call a phase unit. It could be what happens in between two, a coincidence of two different speeds, where they start out, drift apart, come together again. Regard that as a unit, and then magnify that unit in such a way that several smaller units fit inside of that, and then magnify it again, and magnify it again, say, so that you have something like a serialist time continuum in which such phase shifting patterns take place on different expanding or progressive self-similar levels of time. And that might be one approach you could take towards something that you would, in its structural sophistication, be more likely to associate serialism, what you might be hearing on the immediate surface,
yes,
is something that, that you might say, oh, that's like minimalism.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go different places with it. Just briefly,
yeah,
that might be something that you could offer as a proposal to the solution of this problem, if you want to put it that way.
Did you have any kind of, what's the word I should use, reaction from someone like Stockton? Was he aware of what you were doing at that point, and did he have any reaction to it?
We've never really directly talked about it.
I ask because in another case, one of the American legendary composers was very harsh about to another composer who attempted to join or to solve the same similar problem, saying that these were irresolvable and it was not to be dealt with because it was a contamination of a serialist idea. So I just wondered if you had any kind of harsh reaction from what for a long time were two very, very opposed camps, particularly in the States, where you may have preference.
I haven't really come across that. Certainly not from Stockholm. He's always been very friendly to it. So in fact, my last two commissions of the Vivi Air were gotten for me by him. The Vivi Air is the West German radio,
right,
I should say.
Well,
as yet, I haven't been exposed to any real harsh enmities. I guess that's something that I'm in for, maybe.
Fortunate, yes. Well, okay, so you're working in the 70s now that you were working on some of these issues for the first time.
Mm.
You perform, who else performs?
Other people have performed my stuff for me.
No,
I mean, who? Should I go down a list? Or?
No, I meant, what kind of ensemble or performer seeks you out and says, you know, I heard such and so of yours and I'd really like to do
this with you. Quite a few pianists have done pieces of mine because I've written quite a bit for piano. And then I've done four electronic pieces, so that
that those I'm dependent on for forms.
Sure, sure.
And other than that, there have been a few ensemble pieces and then a small orchestra piece.
Yeah. Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Describe one of those events. How did you begin working on that? It sounds like you've talked a lot about keyboard material and mm-hmm. that you yourself played piano and organ. There's a strong even in counterpoint exercises that you talked about, there's a certainly a lot of the keyboard-esque nature of a lot of counterpoint exercises.
Mm-hmm.
What attraction is there to the orchestra?
Well, I used to play in orchestras, and I always loved the instrument, the orchestra as an instrument. I used to play the French horn.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, when I played the piano, I wasn't really a soloist. I played as an orchestra pianist. So it was a kind of sound, a kind of world in which I was always familiar, in which I always enjoyed being in. And I always, ever since I started composing, I thought, well, someday I was going to write something of some kind for an orchestra, if just a small orchestra.
Mm-hmm. We have a recording of that one?
That's the one piece I don't have a recording.
Oh.
I'm working on it.
All right. Well, that's fine.
I ran out of all my recordings of that. I gave them all away in a...
Well, you catch up to us on that one at another time.
I'll catch up to you on that one. I'll go through all my tapes again at home. Maybe I have one somewhere that I could give to you. Yeah.
I guess the question comes now, what kept you in Europe for so long? What is it about either you or Europe or Cologne or who you knew or the culture that kept you there for 3 decades?
Well, one of the things is I'd have to answer is it's something about me, and that is a tendency to inertia. once I get somewhere, I just tend to stay there.
It's a heck of a lot of inertia, 30 years of inertia.
That's a lot of inertia, isn't it? It seemed to be possible for me to dree out my weird in a way that I wanted to dree without too much outside disturbance. I can't really say beyond that.
Mm-hmm. When you first got in touch with me, you mentioned that you knew both Henning Berg and Clarence Barlow.
Mm-hmm.
Have any great anecdotes, embarrassing anecdotes about Clarence or Henning?
<It's> you'd
like to share with us?
I'm not sure I should. Let's see. It's been a little while since I've seen Clarence. Well, no, that's not quite true. He was at our going away party, wasn't he? I can't really think of any embarrassing
anecdotes. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Do you know if Clarence has email yet?
He doesn't. He said he won't have email unless he can also have female.
Oh, right.
Yes, yes. Well, what can we say? That's Clarence. Mm. Well, let's talk off mic a little bit about Clarence. In the meantime, let's hear another piece of yours. John McQuire, music by John McQuire. Thank you.
Go right ahead. I'm speechless.
I was speechless, too. That's Pulse Music 3 from 1979 by John McGuire, produced in the studios of WDR Cologne.
Ah, good place.
Yes, and we are, on the other hand, in the studios of WGDR Plainfield.
Another
Calvos and Damien, New Music Bazaar. And we thank you all for the phone calls during our interview with John McGuire, which will conclude next week on the Calvos and Damien show.
There is more that he says then.
There is more. I must say that John was what we call a tough interview.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He did seem to find all of the questions either too complex or too multifaceted or things that he would have to backtrack a little bit too much.
Yeah. Well.
Yes. Well, what can I tell you? It was one of those difficult things. It was up, after all, with the wind blowing, as you could hear constantly,
yes,
up on the 35th floor. We tried to, in between one of the sections, tried to move the curtains and move ourselves a little bit, but no matter what we did, we just couldn't do it. Plus, John, as you could hear, was speaking so quietly that room noise was always dominant. Well, we'll hear the rest of that next week, and we'll also hear one of his newer pieces. He does not have much recorded, but we will hear a cappella, his piece from 1997, next week. Now,
oh yes, go on.
We have something by Tom Johnson, also not a new piece, but this one of my favorites. This is from an experimental intermedia CD released 7 or 8 years ago. This is Multiplication Table. I find this lots of fun.
Great fun.
Yes,
it
great
is.
Fun. This is with his own introduction. Tom Johnson from the CD Music for 88. This is Multiplication Table.
Everybody knows that 2 times 3 is 6. And that 3 times 2 is also 6. But these two so-called equations are not at all equal, and in fact they have completely different forms. And when you stop to think that 1 times 6 and 6 times 1 are supposed to be equal to the other two, it really makes you wonder how mathematicians have gotten by for so many centuries telling us that unequal things are equal. But we musicians don't make these sorts of mistakes. And in the following musical version of the multiplication table, all of these differences can finally be heard and understood. 1 times 1, 1 times 2, 1 times 3, 1 times 4, 1 times 5, 1 times 6, 1 times 7, 1 times 8, 1 times 9. 2 times 1, 2 times 2, 2 times 3, 2 times 4, 2 times 5, 2 times 6, 2 times 7, 2 times 8, 2 times 9, 3 times 1, 3 times 2, 3 times 3, 4, 3 times 5, 3 times 6, 3 times 7, 3 times 8, 3 times 9, 4 times 1, 4 times 2, systems 1, systems 2, systems 3, systems 4, systems 5, systems 6.
To get to the tens.
Yes, Tom Johnson, who's failing a very difficult piece for string bass, we've also played as well as some other pieces of his. It's a lot of fun. We're scheduled at some point to have an interview with Tom Johnson, but it just hasn't happened yet, and I certainly hope it does. To finish up a little business we haven't mentioned in a while, don't forget to check out our website. We do have our playlists if you want to know what we've played or want to write anti-fan mail with respect to that. You can certainly check us out at maltedmedia.com. That's malted media, like malted milk, which I found out, by the way, is so unknown to those under 35. I did a poll that most don't seem to know how to spell it because they don't know what a malt is.
I see.
So it's M-A-L-T-E-D, maltedmedia.com. and click on the link for Calvos.
You know,
with a K.
When I mentioned that site to other people, I've noticed that too, and it never dawned on me that people wouldn't know what a malted beverage was.
Well, yes. So I did take a poll recently because I was at a trade show in New York City, and each time I gave my address, I said, do you know how to spell that? And they would say M-U-L-T, and I'd say, how old are you? And so I discovered that there was a dividing line right about age 35 that doesn't know what malted is. Malted, M-A-L-T-E-D. Okay, that's about all. The last piece we'll be playing is from the new CD from Tuning at Eartha Mills Edu, a microtonal music experience. This is music by Warren Burt called 12 by 12, Evening in Lancox Park. And I'm happy to say that I will be featured on a concert of music, including the music of Warren Burt, this June in Manhattan.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What's your tune?
I haven't written it yet.
Ah. Yes. Do they know that?
They do know I haven't written it. They do expect it within about 6 weeks.
Ah, excellent.
So here's music by Warren Burt, 12 by 12, Evening in Lancox Park.
A production of Baltic Media.